Anyway, we have two distinguished commentators today, Professor Tanaka Akihiko of Tokyo University and Professor Shimizu Manabu of Sophia University. So we begin from Professor Tanaka, please.
Well, thank you, Professor Nakai, and also I'm grateful for the organization as well as Professor Iwashita for inviting me to this fascinating conference. The conference is extremely educational to me, as all the three panelists presented to us a clear characteristics of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is not particularly well known in this country, even amongst the specialists on international affairs. I think I'm quite grateful for the three panelists to shed light on the nature of the SCO. And having listened to their presentations, I have three sets of understandings of SCO. One, globally. Second, regionally, or in terms of regional institutions. And finally, in terms of Japan's diplomacy toward SCO. First, globally, I have the impression, after listening to the presentation, that we are now in a sort of a staged of a more nuanced understanding of the subject matter of SCO. To put it differently, the age of neoconservative is over. The black and white distinction between friends and enemies are now sort of behind us. It used to be the case, somehow, the SCO was regarded as an enemies organization or friends organizations, or, you know, who are they? But then it seems that the characterization made by both Dr. Katz and Dr. Antonenko somehow corrected the simplified characterizations of SCO wrong. I also add to say that Dr. Iwashita's diagram is a very interesting new way to look at geopolitical reality nowadays by distinguishing what I might call borderful relations and borderless relations. Borderful, relations are tied up with the border relations, but then the borderless relations would give you some free hand, as in the case of the United States with respect to Central Asia or Uzbekistan with respect to the United States. The second set of my response is characterization of SCO as an regional institutions. And then I come to realize that how it has similarities with other regional organizations that we have in Asia. Dr. Antonenko said that 4 points that countries are still in the midst of nation building and weak, and then it doesn't have supernatural institutions, and then there are maybe a rivalry between China and Russia, and then there's still a lot of problems in terms of democracies and human rights. I think if you look at what's happening in ASEAN, in the last 30 years had been organization of members who are very weak in the midst of nation building, and ASEAN has never developed any supranational institutions, and there are always internal contradictions between Indonesia, and Thailand. Maybe in this respect, ASEAN plus three may be somewhat more similar to SCO, because in ASEAN plus three, which was created in 1997, has often be characterized by the rivalry between Japan and China. And then, you know, ASEAN, either ASEAN or ASEAN plus three, there are, you know, problematic countries in terms of democracy building or human rights. Just to name one, you know, Myanmar is always in our member. So I think somehow, you know, we can usefully compare the development of SCO with the development of other regional organizations that are, you know, emerging in East Asia. I think I have some questions to Dr. Katz and Dr. Antonenko. I'm quite impressed with Dr. Katz's summary of the Putin's vision of SCO. And he, I think, pointed out the limitations of Putin's visions. I think if because he's so persuasive that not many people do not believe in Putin's vision is viable. But my question is that still I have the impression that some Americans are sort of influenced by what he called as the Putin's vision of SCO when Americans look at SCOs. And SCO is being characterized as something that Putin wanted to be. Therefore, you have to be very, very careful and cautious. I understand his viewpoint, and it's very persuasive, but what I would like to know, if he could give us his sense of American understanding of SCO. And in particular, you know, U.S. is now in the midst of a presidential campaign, too early a presidential campaign, but still it's already in the midst of presidential campaign. What does he think about the prospect of American approach to SCO during the presidential campaign, as well as after the next presidential election? And then finally, I would like to make some comments about SCO in terms of Japan's diplomacy. In my understanding, Central Asia was a relatively neglected area of Japan's diplomacy in the last, in the Koizumi administration. It was the time of Hashimoto government that the Japanese government created a word, Eurasian diplomacy, and promoted some ties with the Central Asian countries. And then Prime Minister Obuchi, it seems to me, had a fairly consistent attention to what's happening in Central Asia. But somehow, unfortunately, after Mori administration to Koizumi administration, The two governments of Japan had paid relatively little attention to Central Asia, most particularly SCO. It is true that the Japanese government created what's it's called the Central Asia plus one, Central Asia plus Japan approach. And it is true that Mr. Koizumi, in the final months of his administration, went to Central Asian countries. But I have the impression that it has not been the result of a sort of a systematic attention to Central Asia in Kasumigaseki here. I hope that the current administration under Mr. Abe is improving in terms of its attention to Central Asia. But then still I have some doubts because Mr. Aso, foreign minister, is always using his catchword of arc of freedom and prosperity. And that could include Japan's approach to Central Asia. But somewhat surprisingly, Prime Minister Abe himself does not mention very much about arc of freedom and prosperity. Instead, he's, it seems to me, focusing more on what he called Asia Gateway concept, which is more focused on Southeast Asia. I'm not sure what will happen after June 29th. We may have a new government, or we may continue to see Mr. Abe as a prime minister. But I think we need to ask our government to focus more on sort of an integrated Asia policy. So far, unfortunately, I think Japan's Asian policy, including Central Asia policy, Southeast Asian policy, China policy, is somewhat sort of a, what I might call a hodgepodge Asianism. Some fragments there, and not very coherent. I think what Professor Iwashita mentions are all true. Japan has advantage in dealing with Central Asian countries, and I think by Japan acting as a sort of a useful dialogue partner with SCO, Japan could play a more constructive role in stabilizing the relations there. If you remember what I said about the similarities between ASEAN, ASEAN plus three, and SCO, you know, the concept of dialogue partner has been utilized by ASEAN for many, many years. The ASEAN created this concept in the late 1970s and early 1980s. And Japan was one of the first dialogue partners of ASEAN. And then out of this dialogue partners, and the EU was a dialogue partner of ASEAN. And then out of that, ASEAN created what's called the post-ministerial conference of ASEAN that is generally held in late July. I think this sort of a similar evolution could be possible with respect to SCO. And for that purposes, I think if the government listens to Dr. Iwashita more carefully, then Japan could play a more constructive role in the coming months and years. Thank you very much.
Since Professor Tanaka has to leave, say, in 15 minutes or so I'd like to invite your comments first. Professor Katz?
Yes, thank you. The question is directed at me. What is the American understanding of the SCO, and how might the presidential, how might American approach to the SCO, both before and after the election? I have a feeling that in the remaining 18 months and 2 days of the Bush administration, that the Bush administration at best will not concentrate very much on the SCO. In other words, that I think that either it's going to ignore it or it's going to see it as hostile. And much of that might be determined next month. In other words, will Kyrgyzstan expel the American forces? I have a feeling that if the Kyrgyz have their way, they will not. But if Kyrgyzstan, if it's prevailed upon to do so, then the U.S. will see the SCO as hostile. If Iran became a full member, I personally don't think this would be the end of the world. I don't think it would necessarily change an awful lot, but certainly the Bush administration would. This would be a move that would be seen as negative, and I don't think that there'd be much inclination to have a dialogue with it. Now, you know, we're going to see a number of changes. This is supposedly the last SCO summit that Putin will attend as president of Russia. There's supposedly going to be a new Russian president next March, and of course, who knows how Russian policy might change? Maybe not at all. Maybe dramatically. Maybe a different personality might make a difference. So there'll be a new Russian president next year, and then a new American president. I have a feeling that America is going to be focused on the withdrawal from Iraq for the next several years, either the Bush administration trying to postpone it and pass it off to the next administration. And so I don't see that this administration as sort of as making an effort to achieve dialogue. And maybe that's why we need the EU and Japan to do so, because if they consider it a priority, maybe that would be helpful to us. And I certainly think that it's very useful that America, the EU, Japan are interested in different things and talk about the SCO and sort of nudge it along on different ways. So I'm sorry, that's not a satisfactory answer, but that's about all I can give.
Thank you very much. Yosan, do you have a comment?
Thank you very much, Professor Tanaka, for commenting on comparison studies of SCO and ASEAN. I'm not a person who should defend Kasumigaseki's position on Japan's Eurasian foreign policy. But one thing to be mentioned, Hashimoto's diplomacy on Eurasia pay much attention to Russia. But recently, Central Asia plus Japan format and recent Koizumi's visit to Central Asia, I think it means that Japan's started to make a commitment to the Central Asia as a separate area from other independent areas. I think this is a good progress. So I don't know the Aso and Abe's position, but please see this map. This is a map made by the Foreign Ministry Aso, Arc for Freedom and Prosperity. This light green area is Arc. So I think why today we together here, so regardless of the result of the coming election, we should discuss on the future of Japanese foreign policy and toward the Eurasia, and we discuss here to make the contents of the arc, if possible. This is my position. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Professor Tanaka, for your very insightful comments. I want to react to one point that you mentioned about the ASEAN and SCO being more similar to ASEAN. I think from the European perspective, it is very interesting that the reason why the new EU strategy towards Central Asia is such a watershed is because the European Union now, and for the first time, is starting to treat Central Asia not as a post-Soviet space, exactly as Professor Vashita just said, but as an Asian space. And I think as this transformation happened, there is a whole transformation of expectations about Central Asia. In the past, in the 1990s, the European Union very much perceived Central Asia from the point of view of a kind of model of transition economies. So in some ways, in the sort of simplistic terms, it was Kazakhstan or Kyrgyzstan equals Poland, you know, in terms of, or equals, you know, Czech Republic, in terms of its expectations on transition. And therefore, I think there is this problem that a lot of European Union assistance money was spent on a lot of projects that actually never could have brought any fruit, because Central Asia, in fact, was not ready on a similar level as Central Europe was, you know, in actually administering both democratic reforms, but even economic transformation. It is the countries with a totally different mentality, totally different starting point, and totally different expectations, you know, within their own societies. And they, I would argue, even only now starting the process of nation building, many of them, for example, Tajikistan, which, you know, went through 5 years of bloody civil war. So, in some ways, you know, now that the European Union for the first time is looking at Central Asia as Asia, not as a continuation or extension of Europe or Eurasia, yeah, I think there is now a complete different, very realistic approach of how it could be treated. And here the ASEAN model is actually very useful, because if we look at the ASEAN and study ASEAN, you know, it can actually guide us to try to quite, you know, accurately predict how SCO is going to evolve. SCO is not going to evolve into European Union with lots of supranational institutions, because it's very hard in the weak states to develop supranational institutions. These states have to first consolidate their sovereignty. And that's why, you know, as Professor Katz said about tensions between various Central Asian states, I wouldn't actually put all the blame on Uzbekistan, I have to say. I mean, lots of other factors are at fault why, you know, Central Asian states have lots of problems with each other. I mean, you know, the truth is that, you know, they are just in a different paradigm than the Eurasian states. Therefore, I mean, I'm all in favor of comprehensive Eurasian strategy. You know, and your idea of Eurasian community is a very good one. But actually, I think before we transition towards Eurasian community, I think it would be very useful to consolidate Asian community. And I think to kind of pull and place Central Asia firmly within Asian identity, kind of distinguish it from, so to speak, you know, European Eurasian expectations, would actually help us a great deal. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now Tanaka-san has to go, and we have Shimizu-sensei. Thank you for waiting. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm very grateful to the opportunity given to me to express my views on the former distinguished presenter's, I mean, speech. I would like to raise two or three issues concerning the SCO. I've been following the development of SCO for the last 10 years. As a specialist of the area studies in the south, not from the north, I mean that not from the from Russia. And the first point which I would like to raise is that the organization of SCO is not a so-called organization which have a very fixed object and a very fixed agenda and object. And because for the last 10 years, after the Shanghai Five, the main purpose of the organization have changed themselves. The first one is a sort of the confidence building among the countries, related countries. And the second is second I mean, target is a sort of the fight against so-called terrorism, inter-terrorism. And the third phase came with the acceptance of the three or four observer countries. I mean the Mongolia, India, Pakistan, and Iran, particularly Iran. And so I would say that the SCO is, so to speak, always, I mean, the transforming itself vis-à-vis the external circumstances and also the among the members and including the observers. And so when we look at the SCO, we had better not to make a so-called predetermined image of the SCO. This is the first point which I'd like to raise. And the second point is that the actors in the SCO are also changing very practically. And although the Uzbekistan is picked up against one member who is supposed to be against the United States interest to some extent, but the Uzbekistan itself, I mean, the Prime Minister, President Islam Karimov himself changed the attitude towards the external factors very practically. Once he tried to accommodate with the Taliban, and he changed his course. And he tried to approach the United States, and they changed his course. So he's very practical, in a sense. So there is a very possibility for the changing the sort of the attitude of the actors of those, I mean, the member organizations or the member states. And the second point, which I would like, is the sort of principles on which SCO is found. As Professor Tanaka pointed out, the basic principle of organizing this kind of regional cooperation seem to me a little different from the principle which are raised by the United States or the EU, in the sense that the Asian countries have all different, the religion and the cultures. So we don't have any common, so-called common values or common standards, which could be applied to everyone. The if you take up the example of the ASEAN, for instance, there are countries are called Christian countries, and Buddhist, Islam, and those the countries with different cultural background have to form one regional organization. So principles of the formulating this kind of organization are very, very practical, and without going into the basic sort of the value system. So the when we take up the example of SCO, I think this issue is a sort of a mixture between the Asian principle and the European principle. And so the this is my impression that the it is important to have a dialogue for the US and the EU. It is something necessary to understand this so-called Asian, the background for having this kind of regional cooperation. And the third point is a little minor one. I think that the status of Iran is one of the very sensitive elements when outsider try to evaluate the role of SCO. And in this case, it is very interesting to note a sort of the differences or perception of the Islamic so-called radical movements. And I try to take up the Hizb Tahrir, Party of the Liberation. And all of the Central Asian republics, particularly Uzbekistan, is very much worried about this Hizb Tahrir. But the attitude of the United States is very vague in this respect. And the United States didn't include Hizb Tahrir within the list of the international terrorist organization. So for instance, one of the reasons why Uzbekistan is, trying to find out a real reason of the American attitude to the Central Asia. And the third point is Japan's relations with Central Asia. And I think that Japan's approach to Central Asia is now, taking a more active and positive role than before by locating Central Asia within the total framework of the so-called arc of freedom and prosperity. And I would say that Central Asia has become much more important than before for Japan, not only from the strategic point, but also from the economic point of view, because the Japan is now facing the problems, the energy, but also the the difficulty of getting the rare metal for the Japanese industry, and we depend too much on the China. But China now cannot afford to export those rare metals, and we have to find out alternatives. And in this process, the Central Asia, particularly Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, I expect to be another important source of supply for rare metal. And so the, in the end, I would like to support the major proposal of Professor Iwashita that the Japan can and should play a sort of the intermediary role between the SCO and the Western countries, including the United States. As I mentioned, SCO could be changed flexible to the external forces. If Japan is admitted as a sort of the partner of dialogue, the itself could have an impact on the process of the SCO. Of course, not strongly enough, but this status of the partnership could be also one factor for transformation of the SCO. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Shimizu.